Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is episode number 266, and I'm your host, Jason Hartman, and a good morning to you from Phoenix, Arizona, where it is 8 a.m. and it's 88 degrees, but it's a dry heat, as they say. Hey, so today we've got a great show for you. We've got a client interview. You'll hear from one of our clients, a doctor who is investing in real estate and just out of medical school fairly recently and going down the right track. Some say, you know, doctors are people who pay attention to their profession, but not their investment portfolio and not the business side of their life because they're scientists. But this one is, and I got to hand it to him. He's going to do a great job and have a lot of success, I can just tell, with his real estate investing. So you'll hear about that in just a few minutes. And gosh, today, well, what do you want first, the good news or the bad news? Well, there's always a way to make bad news good news. Well, I guess not everything, but most of it, at least most of the stuff I talk about here. So I guess I'll start with the bad news. California, my old home, the Socialist Republic of California, two bankruptcies in 1 week. Now, these aren't bankruptcies for people or businesses, mind you. These are bankruptcies for cities. Yes, two California cities have gone bankrupt in just 1 week. One, of course, you're probably familiar with. There has been much written about this one and much media attention, and that is good old Stockton, California. I'm sure that one doesn't surprise you. This from a Newser article. By the way, thanks to Kyle for recommending Newser to me a couple of years ago, one of our listeners. I like Newser because it's just short and quick. In fact, their tagline is "Read less, but no more." So basically two paragraph news stories really gets to the point quickly. Remember, you know, when you were in school and you probably learned a little bit about the way journalists write with that inverted pyramid format? Well, the important stuff is usually pretty much at the beginning of the article anyway, and it allows you to read a lot more stories. But sometimes you want more depth, and you can always click on the link for the full article if you want to hear all about it. But this one's interesting. So this is the biggest city bankruptcy in the United States so far, and that is Stockton. California City expected to file paperwork today, and that was a June 27th article. The city of Stockton, California will file today for bankruptcy protection, becoming the largest city in the U.S. ever to do so. The San Francisco Chronicle reports Stockton, a river port and agricultural city of nearly 300,000 people, about 90 miles east of San Francisco, became a victim of California's housing crash. During the mid-2000s economic boom, the city, long mired in poverty, attempted to reinvent itself, building a new marina and sports complex, a fancy hotel, and new housing tracks, and a promenade on credit. Today, those posh areas are blocks away from dangerous, violent neighborhoods, the Los Angeles Times reports, and the rate of foreclosure is the second highest in the nation. All that's left is sadness, in quotes, said the town's retired fire chief after last night's 6-1 city council vote in favor of bankruptcy. The city cut the police department by 25%, and last year saw a record-setting 58 homicides. Can you imagine that? 58 murders in a town of only 300,000 people. That is pretty scary. This is what happens when bad, bad economic times hit a city. It's really instructive. By the way, that's me talking. I think you can tell where my comments are thrown in. There have been 31 homicides so far this year, the BBC reports. The fire department was cut by 30% and other city employees cut by 40%. Employee pay and benefits, once perhaps overly generous, I'm sure they were also cut. Stockton also has the state's second highest rate of violent crime and an unemployment rate higher than 15%. Now, all of you listeners to the Creating Wealth Show, of course, know that that 15% is the way the government understates and calculates it. So when you see 15%, that probably really means about 25 to 30% in true unemployment. Many city buildings have been repossessed, including City Hall. Wells Fargo took over a few parking garages the city owned as well. Says one local, quote, "Now they own the building that the City Hall is in. You might as well call it Wells Fargo Town." Wow. You know, and it's interesting to see sometimes, I don't know, they tend to be so snarky and pessimistic, but sometimes they're accurate. I like to read the comments on some of these posts. And one of them says, "Now you liberals see, we don't need to get violent or upset because in the end, your handouts, cultural diversity commissions, coastal commissions, and massive pension programs will implode on themselves. Socialism, liberalism, progressive will always fail. Call it what you want. It's going to fail." Well, I agree with that. By the way, do you know what the Coastal Commission is? I have had a few different dealings with the Coastal Commission over my years in the real estate business in coastal Southern California. And I tell you, the Coastal Commission has got to be the biggest business chaser away, if that's the proper way to say it. I'm sure it's not. California has one of the biggest, because every time someone wants to build anything you can see from the coast, so if you were out on a boat in the water and you could see it, the Coastal Commission just makes it virtually impossible. I remember I was doing a real estate deal in Malibu years ago and had this client who wanted to buy a $2.2 million property. Probably in today's dollars, that would be somewhere around $6 million, I would guess, with true inflation rates. And I'm also kind of taking into account real estate inflation rates. They wanted to buy this property and it killed my deal. The Coastal Commission just killed my deal because the developer of the property didn't quite get the permits done properly. And I mean, look, folks, it was a beautiful home on the coastline in Malibu, California, and just destroying economic activity at every turn. Okay, well, that's the bad news. But again, always a way to turn bad news into an opportunity, which, by the way, reminds me, our next show, episode number 267, we will have the author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. You're going to love this one. I hope you got that book as I had recommended before. It's fantastic. Peter Diamantis and Stephen Kotler have done a great job telling us how incredible our future really is going to be. And there are so many reasons to be so, so optimistic. Before I jump into the next story, which is good news, I want to just tell you about a couple of properties here. We have been able to get some really, really long-awaited, much-needed, outstanding inventory recently. And if you're a regular follower of the show, if you're a client of my company, you know that inventory has been extremely, extremely scarce for us. So I'm glad to say it's gotten a little bit better just recently. Here's one in Memphis, Tennessee, 29% projected ROI. And look at this property, okay? $56,900, so very inexpensive. $44 per square foot, subject to qualifying with 25% down. All you need to get into this property, including your closing cost, is about $17,900. And let me just share with you the rest of the projections, and I'm going to share some on a few more properties here after the next story. Projected rent, $850. Projected positive cash flow here of $234 per month, or $2,800 per year, which leads you to an overall cash-on-cash return of 16% annually. Now remember, cash-on-cash is assuming there's no appreciation. In fact, if the property goes down in value and it's only worth a dollar, as long as you maintain that income and expense ratio, you'll produce your cash-on-cash return of a whopping 16% annually. And the overall return on investment here of 29% annually. Pretty darn phenomenal, to say the least. Now, Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, a market that we did some business in a few years back, and I own property in myself. This is really good news. I remember they were talking about this. Well, it looks like it's finally, finally happening here. Airbus plans its first U.S. assembly plant in Alabama. Okay, now Airbus, of course, the airplane manufacturer. Airbus plans to invest several hundred million dollars in a new plant in Mobile, Alabama, which would be the European plane manufacturer's first factory on U.S. soil, sources tell the New York Times. This move would ramp up its competition with Boeing, which has been the only company building large commercial aircraft in the U.S. since 1997, Flight Global notes. The assembly line, which is at least 3 or 4 years away from starting operations, could annually produce dozens of A320 jets, the best-selling commercial jetliner in the world. Airbus currently holds only 20% share of the American market for single-aisle planes, which are increasingly replacing older aircraft that are not as fuel efficient. Although globally its share is about even with Boeing's, the plane maker expects that the A320 made in the USA would be more competitive with Boeing's 737, while also lowering production costs. But some in Europe will likely be concerned with the overseas plant, although it could eventually create about 10 European jobs for every one in Alabama. Airbus also has strong ties to Mobile, the Press Register reports, and currently has 200 employees at an Airbus engineer center there. Anyway, so that's interesting. Now, what's interesting about that European comment about outsourcing, we have largely been making that same complaint in the U.S. for many years now that the jobs are going overseas. Well, one of the comments at the end of this blog post here is jobs outsourced to the United States from overseas were being third worldized by subsidized industries from other countries. Interesting. That is interesting, by the way. That's a very interesting comment. You know, well, I'll get to that in just a moment. I want to tell you about another property here, but I want to share with you in a moment the most amazing thing about housing cost. You are not going to believe this. Just another property here. Again, some great inventory lately. This one in Atlanta, Georgia, okay? The Stone Mountain area. You can, by the way, you can find these all on our website at jasonhartman.com, of course. But this property, 2,200 square feet, beautiful property. Get this. The price is only $99,000. And it's $45 per square foot. Total cash needed to buy based on qualifying for an 80% loan to value is just over $23,000. And here are the way the numbers look here on the pro forma. $1,250 per month rent, $375 per month positive cash flow. That's almost $4,500 per year. And a cash on cash return. Get this. Are you sitting down? This is going to blow your mind. Cash on cash return of 19% annually, and an overall return on investment at 37% annually. You know what I always say, folks? Even if it doesn't work out this well, it's still pretty darn awesome. Even if it only works out half as good as this, take 37% and divide by 2, and your return on investment is still phenomenal at just under 20%. I mean, you can't beat that. Now, let me tell you about a property that I noticed when I was printing these off to talk about on the show today on our website. And this is one of the big, big mistakes that people can make. Our local market specialists upload properties to our website. This one is in Tennessee. And, you know, we try to catch all of these. We don't catch all of them. We're not perfect. And I caught this one, and we will, of course, take it down. In fact, I believe it's already been deleted, so you can't look at what I'm going to tell you. But here is something that shocked me. I was looking for properties to talk to you about on the show, and this one said, total return on investment, 114%. Well, I knew that was patently ridiculous, right? Because one of the things I do not allow our local market specialist or our investment counselors at my real estate company, what I don't allow them to do is make the initial market value different from the purchase price on the pro forma, because this is what happens. Now, let me run through this one with you because it's a good lesson in how you can be misled as an investor. But first, I want to say, look, do you sometimes buy a property that is below market value? Sure you do. We've had many instances where properties will appraise much higher than our client is purchasing them for. We've had numerous incidents. In fact, this probably happens almost every time, and I don't even know about it, where the insurance is basically saying, the insurance company is basically saying, you've got to insure this property for a lot more than you paid for it, because it would cost so much more to rebuild the property than our clients actually purchased them for. Well, this property here is $100,000 is what the local market specialist, although contrary to our instruction, put the property on the website for, and they said you could purchase it for $81,900. So look what happens here when those numbers are askew, when they are not the same. We require all of our local market specialists to have the initial market value and the purchase price number be the same. In other words, they cannot say or represent to you, our client, that you are getting that property below market value, even though many times, are you? Yeah, I think you are. And many of you listeners have already experienced that yourself firsthand. So running through this pro forma, you see the difference in purchase price versus initial market value. That's what would just really jacks up the return on investment inaccurately, in my opinion. So positive cash flow here, $300 a month or $3,600 per year. And just going down the pro forma, cash on cash return, 16%. It's still a great property, but when you get to overall return on investment, it's projected at 114% annually. Well, that's just too high. That's unrealistic, in my opinion, and we're not going to let people play with the numbers like that. We're just going to assume that you're paying market value for the property. If you get a better deal, hey, that's icing on the cake, so good for you. Okay, two more things before we go to our guest today. The cost of owning a home. Did you see this in the media? This is phenomenal. This is from the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University, and this is going to just amaze you, what I'm about to say. There is a table, and on the table, it's pretty simple. It's four rows down and three columns wide. It shows that in 1990, now these numbers are adjusted for inflation, but of course, remember, they're adjusted for inflation, I'm sure, on the, quote, official, unquote, statistics. You want to learn more about that, listen to the show with John Williams of Shadow Stats. And because John Williams is such a brilliant guy, but a little harder to listen to, I'd say, on that show, I think that was show number 251, we actually posted the transcript of that show if you'd like to read it on the blog at jasonhartman.com and just click on blog. But understanding inflation and so forth, John Williams, very good at helping people understand that with his website, shadowstats.com. But here, look at this. Amazing numbers. In 1990, the median mortgage payment was $1,183. And the payment to income ratio, so they took the median payment, median house, and the median income, and it was 0.28. That was the ratio, 0.28. The payment to rent ratio back then was terrible. It was 1.45. Now, terrible depends on who you are. Are you the investor or are you the tenant? Depends, right? Well, let's talk about that in just a moment, but first let's go through the rest of the numbers. 10 years later, fast forward 10 years to 2000, the year 2000, the mortgage payment in 2011 dollars is $1,125. The payment to income ratio is 0.24. And the payment to rent ratio is 1.37. Now let's fast forward again, but this time only 6 years. We're going to take a middle of the decade thing. And this is instructive because it really looks at the hot, frothy, crazy market we had. And so let's look at 2006. That mortgage payment was $1,240. And the payment to income ratio was 0.28. just like it was way back 16 years earlier in 1990, but the payment to rent ratio was 1.44. Now, this is where you need to be sitting down, because this number is just going to put the biggest smile on your face as an investor. It is unbelievable. It really, really shows the incredible opportunity we have right now at this very moment to lock in our cost of ownership and our cost of financing for 3 decades. Well, cost of ownership is locked in forever, the cost of purchasing it, but the cost of financing for 3 decades. Listen to this. But this also brings something bad with it too, because what this means, because there is so much imbalance, beneficial imbalance to us, the investors in this market, this means that it will start to adjust. It will start to adjust out of our favor. And I say, as we predicted about 2 years ago, that this is about the very best point right now and maybe over the last 6 months. That's why business is so good. That's why so many investors are buying up everything they can get. In 2011, that mortgage payment number, $669. Wow. It's about half of what it's been anywhere since 1990. You look over the last 21 years, that median mortgage payment is about half of where it's been. And get this, the payment to income ratio, to show you how incredibly affordable housing is, it is by far the best it's been in the last 21 years at 0.15. Remember, in 1990, it was 0.28, and then in 2000, it got better. It was 0.24. Now it's 0.15. Again, about half. And look at the payment to rent ratio. This is the part that will adjust in the future out of favor for investors, I believe. That's my prediction. Okay, it's very good right now, very desirable right now, but that imbalance in the market will start to right itself, and you're already seeing this, where properties are appreciating in price, and rents are still escalating, but that imbalance ultimately will correct itself. The reason rents are escalating, and we've talked about this many times before, is because although this is so incredibly imbalanced, it would normally adjust much faster, but we have some special circumstances. It's very hard to get a loan, okay? So you can't get the financing. It's great if you can. That's why if you're not obtaining all the financing you possibly can now, you are missing out on a huge opportunity. But number two, and this plays into that number one reason, is that so many people during the last several years have really destroyed their credit, either by choice through strategic default or just through general economic hardship in the circumstances. So the payment to rent ratio right now, again, it's about half of those prior numbers at 0.77. This is a phenomenal, phenomenal opportunity. And here is another illustration of that. You know, we're very much about real world here on the Creating Wealth Show. Well, here's another illustration of that. This is a fourplex in the market that is under the radar that you shouldn't forget about. It is good old St. Robert, Missouri. I have a property here myself, and this has been a great under-the-radar market, the one that nobody's really paying much attention to. And this one, $215,000, it'll take, subject to qualifying for the financing outlined at jasonhartman.com in the property section, it'll take about $31,000 to buy it. But look at the pro forma here. Projected rent, $2,620 per month. That leaves you positive cash flow of $557 per month and an overall cash-on-cash return at 22% annually, and an overall return on investment of 48% annually. Wow. Again, even if it only goes half as good as the pro forma says, your cash on cash would be 11%, and your overall return on investment would be 24%. Income property, no wonder it is the most historically proven wealth creator in history, because it has such unique multidimensional characteristics. It is phenomenal. You know, I had another argument last week, and I shouldn't call it an argument. I'll call it a debate on good old Facebook again, okay? And if you want to see these, you know, you can find me on Facebook and look me up. And of course, we've got all our pages with a lot of our free content, and you can look those up on Facebook as well. But this one was with a gold bug again. We were talking about income property compared to gold. And he says, well, income or gold has outperformed real estate. Well, of course, you're not taking into account the special characteristics of real estate, because, of course, you don't just look at appreciation. You look at appreciation, leverage, tax benefits, income, cash flow that the property produces, and nothing even comes close, folks. And we all know that if you've been listening regularly. So happy investing to you. Here is a case study story of what one of our clients is doing, and we are glad to have so many of these case studies on the show. We've got several more coming up for you, and we will go to that here in just less than 60 seconds.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn more about investing in real estate in different markets, there's a show for that. If you want to learn 17 ways rich people think and act differently, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to get paid to borrow, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know why Amsterdam doesn't take dollars or why pools are for fools, there are even shows for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com, or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome one of our clients to the show. We're very grateful to whenever we can get a client on the show and you can hear their firsthand experiences, as the saying goes, from the horse's mouth, as it were. And my pleasure to welcome Tap to the show. He lives in Venice, California, and I actually went to Venice High for a year, so I know that area well. And Tap, it's great to be talking with you. How are you?
I'm great, Jason. Great to be on.
Good. Well, my pleasure. So you are a physician, and you're recently out of medical school, or I guess out of your residency, I should say, right?
Right.
And tell us a little bit about your story as to maybe just go chronologically. Where did you go to medical school?
Yeah, so I went to University of Pennsylvania out in the East Coast, and I went to med school, residency, and fellowship all over there in Philly. I'm from the East Coast, grew up North Jersey near New York City, and I finished my training just under 2 years ago, and I decided I want to live near the beach. I lived in Chicago and on the East Coast. I'd never lived on the West Coast, so I hopped in my car, drove cross country, and found a job in Southern California where I wanted to be. And then, as some people may know, as soon as you get out of training, as a physician, your salary kind of goes from very low to pretty comfortable. And so I spent several months sort of living the good life, spending money I had not, you know, had before that. And you can spend money in Southern California without too much trouble.
That's pretty easy to do, yeah.
Yeah, whatever, you know, whether on taxes or goods or services. And then after like 9 months, you know, it kind of occurred to me that I didn't really care about all these things. And I figured out very quickly that making a lot of money doesn't actually make much difference in your happiness, apart from, you know, having some financial security and some independence. And so I decided, you know, I wanted to get into investing. I enjoy investing. I enjoy business. I just had never had an opportunity to do it before. And I kind of got the idea that, you know, I want to, if I practice medicine or do research or whatever, I'd like to do it on my own terms and not really do it for the money, but to have some other sources of income. So I got, about a year ago, I started researching investments, everything, you know, angel investing, real estate, notes, stocks, everything. Initially, I was thinking about flipping houses in Southern California. I don't know why. That's just what people at real estate meetings seem to talk about. And after a few weeks of looking into that, I realized I didn't have the time or interest in being a house flipper. You know, I'd much rather be a physician if I'm going to work that hard. And it wasn't a great market for it anyway. So the more I did the research, the more I realized I wanted to buy cash flowing. You know, I came to this conclusion on my own, really independently of, you know, before I ever met you. But, you know, cash flowing rental properties in sort of moderately priced, good job markets in cheaper parts of the country like the South, certain cities in the Midwest. And I looked at a bunch of markets and I started finding these sort of turnkey places, like the ones that you work with, initially on my own. And I just kind of decided I felt very comfortable with a particular vendor and market in Memphis. And I purchased a property over the phone, which I never thought I would do, but it was a low price point, under $50,000, which I figured if it went wrong, I wasn't going to lose my shirt. And that experience was so easy and so good that I bought another one with them about 3 or 4 months later. And so I've had those two properties for about 6 to 9 months, and I've never even received one problem phone call. It's been so easy. So then I decided to diversify, and I started kind of like researching more broadly. I already talked to a lot of turnkey places, And I started discovering networks like yourself. And, I went and started going to meetings for those networks. And I have to say, they do a good service. They introduce you to good people and sort of, do a little bit of education. But I wasn't very impressed with some other networks that I worked with. And I felt comfortable doing it on my own if I didn't have a network. But, at some point I talked to one of your sort of investor specialist counselor, and she was just great. So interpersonally, we got along great, and we still do. And so I came to your meeting, Meet the Masters, about 3 months ago, and it was just a totally different experience. And, it was educational. It was interesting. It was really nuts and bolts stuff. And what I really, what kind of sold me, apart from the fact that I thought everyone I met was from your company was great and very straightforward and very honest, and I thought the whole structure was very educational. I actually learned things. What I really liked, what kind of sold me, the linchpin, was when your sort of market specialist came up to talk, you were kind of happy to grill them on, weaknesses in their market or their model just as much as, you were sort of propping them up. You were not afraid of asking them tough questions. You weren't really there to be a salesperson. It didn't seem like that to me anyway. You were really there to help the investors make a decision on what they liked and what they didn't. And that was different. It wasn't like a sales pitch. It was more of really you were kind of on our side. So I liked that. And I bought two properties. I just closed on my first property in St. Louis last week, which is a duplex. And I have another single family in St. Louis with you guys, through you guys. That I am under contract, and I just visited Dallas last week, and I checked out some properties down there, including with your market specialist in Dallas. In Dallas or Atlanta are probably the next place I'm going to go.
Yeah, I think those are good decisions. Tap, one of the things that we've always done, and I don't know why, it's just sort of part of our company culture, is we fall out of alignment with our local market specialists frequently. In fact, we've been in little conflicts with them from time to time. Not usually the people we're working with, but we've fired several of them. We've had litigation with one of them because we thought he was doing a bad job and just not taking care of our clients. And, I think one of the great things about us is we really understand who our customer is. It's our customer, the client, you, not the local market specialist. And, well, they're great, and we depend on their support, and we support them when they're doing things rightly. We're not afraid to really part ways with them and do our own thing, because we know that ultimately we can get new suppliers, but if you burn a bridge with a customer, that's just going to ruin your business. The customer is king, as the old saying goes, right?
Yeah, and one thing you said that you're at the Meet the Masters, which struck me, and I think kind of reaffirmed that you actually visit these markets, you look at them yourself, and these are markets that you believe in. And, and I didn't get that impression. I kind of got the impression that some other networks, although, again, very nice people, were a little bit of a pass-through entity. They were just kind of, sending us the contact information, and it didn't do the due diligence. I didn't really see that there was due diligence with regards to they had invested with those people, or they had really made sure that those properties and markets were the right ones. And so the fact that you were kind of willing to pass up markets and opportunities to make money to just work in markets that you liked or believed in, that impressed me as well at that time.
I tell you, if we were willing to work in Detroit and Las Vegas and a whole bunch of markets, I got, and some foreign markets. One guy a couple weeks ago was pitching me on doing stuff in the Caribbean, and we could make money short term doing all those things. But the key is to really stick with your focus, cash flowing properties. It's amazing to me how many people as investors think that the definition of an investment is such a broad definition. Sometimes it's just, oh, this property is a good deal because it'll appreciate, so they think. And we don't believe in appreciation. It's great when it happens, but we're not investing for that reason. We're investing for sensible cash flow things. So you were living the good life initially, and you decided, well, I better not blow all this good fortune now that I've worked so hard to be a doctor. What kind of physician are you, by the way?
I'm an oncologist.
Okay. Great.
Cancer doc. Yeah.
So yeah, you're taking care of people in their time of greatest need, probably. And what were your thoughts about investing? I mean, was there like a first book that you read or a first thing that you saw on TV or something? What sparked your interest?
I think what sparked my, so when I started getting into investing, I'd say it's about 15 months ago, I had done a little bit, I would say, sort of investing with friends, not necessarily sort of bread and butter investing, but for example, you know, a couple of friends and myself started an art gallery in New York, which is a small gallery, doing surprisingly well, but that was kind of like an entrepreneurial thing. I did a little bit of angel investing, and then a couple of my friends were in real estate, and I started talking to them about it, and it just made, the numbers made sense. It immediately sort of, at a very visceral level, I was like, this just makes too much sense. And so that the first were just conversations with friends that were interested. Then I just started reading books on Amazon. I forget the name of the books, but if you just go on Amazon and Google sort of real estate investing, there's some books that get really good reviews, and I read a few of those. Then I went to some real estate investment club meetings in Southern California, and I would say there's some good things and a lot of bad things about clubs like that, in my experience.
Just so you know, the business model of those clubs, and it surprises me, some of those clubs make a lot of money. There's an organization that's sort of the national organization, REIA, Real Estate Investors Association. Basically, the business model of those clubs is there are speakers who are on the circuit of doing REIA clubs. And what they do is they go in and they have a product or a coaching program or something like that to sell. And they give 50%, generally that's the model, 50% of that revenue to the REIA club. And so they'll come in and they'll sell a $700, the very typical deal is like the $700 price point. And they'll sell a $700 or sometimes more, sometimes $3,000 product, you know, or service, maybe teach people how to buy at foreclosure auctions or whatever it is. There's a zillion different products and ideas out there. And they'll give half to the people who host the group. And every month it's a different speaker, and every month it's a totally different philosophy. And there's just no real business model there except to just make money by having speakers come in. And now it's even more competitive for the speakers because they will give more than 50% a lot of times. And 50% I think is darn generous. And so, you know, they'll just raise the price of the product because on educational products, you know, the price has no particular meaning, right? It's just a sort of an ambiguous number. But think about it. If they put 50 people or 100 people in a room and they hear someone talk about their $800 course, so the club's going to make $400 a head, it can be quite a lucrative thing for one evening worth of work. It's a pretty great deal. Some of those clubs are very, very lucrative. I was a member of National REIA before, and I've been to the national meetings where they all get together and all these people from REIA clubs talk. And it's interesting to hear what they say. I never really went into that business, but I guess I was a little bit envious, but...
Yeah,
I think they're making a lot of money without working very hard, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I mean, my experience was that, you know, most of these are just kind of used car salesmen. You know, I think there's a grain of truth in what they teach, and they may themselves be able to pull it off, but they know 99% of the people that buy their course are just not going to be able to do it.
We call it bookshelf decorations and doorstops. Yeah. You know, that's usually what they end up doing,
Yeah, what I'd recommend to anyone who's going to one of those now, and what I would do, because you can learn some things, is just do not bring your money. And so you can't buy anything.
Right. Leave your credit cards and your checkbook
at home.
Totally. Yeah. They're pretty good salesmen there. Some of them are very good closers. They really are. Well, Tap, did you have any particular questions when you started? I know that you originally purchased the one-hour consultation with me, and I really wish we would have recorded that and used that as our show, but because that was a great discussion with you. But what questions did you have then or do you have now that, you know, maybe might be common to the other listeners too?
Yeah. You know, I think one question that's high on my mind right now is what's a better investment, going with the sort of upper, you know, a little bit higher rent areas where you're looking at properties between 100 and 140,000 and the rent might be 12 to 1800, or going in the kind of working class neighborhoods where the properties are 50,000 and the rent 750 and the cash flow is higher, ROI is better, cash on cash seems better, but you know, you may have a little more trouble with tenants, there may be more turnover, maybe less long-term appreciation, maybe more hassle factors. So I'm trying to figure out, I want a low hassle, but you know, whether I should be focused on one or the other and what the trade-offs are. And that's kind of what I've been thinking the last few weeks about.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And let's kind of discuss that now. So first of all, it depends what city you're talking about, because price is a moving target, of course. Mm-hmm. So if you were talking about one city, that's a lower end city, you know, and those would be like in our market, the only two that we do are really Indianapolis and St. Louis that are lower priced. Those markets, you would be 50,000 or 70,000 means one thing, whereas in higher priced markets like Dallas and Phoenix, it means another thing, right? And so that's the first thing to have is identify the segment particular to that market, because it is a bit of a moving target. But generally speaking, Tap, you know, on lower priced properties, you have something called economic vacancy, and that's different than physical vacancy. So physical vacancy is when there's no one in the property and you're not getting any rent. Economic vacancy is when there's someone in the property and you're not getting any rent, which many argue that that's worse. Okay. Physical vacancy or economic vacancy is worse. And generally speaking, the lower end properties have more physical vacancy or more economic vacancy problems because you get a lower quality of tenant. Many times that tenant's credit is already quite damaged and they don't really care about it. They don't view themselves as having a lot to lose or having a big future ahead of them. Whereas, you know, people that have something to lose and people that think they've got a good future ahead of them, they generally will be more careful, more prudent, and more responsible. And I think you'd probably agree that makes sense. The other problem you get is this. It's sort of the what is worth the cost of going after a tenant. So the numbers will generally look much better on lower end properties. So if you have, for example, a property that's, and you can even do less than 50,000, say it's 40,000 and the projected rent is 700, great RV ratio, right? The problem you have there is if the tenant doesn't pay, to some extent there are flat fees involved in terms of how much you have to pay to hire an eviction attorney, to collect, to pay court fees and so forth. And at some point, you know, and I think a lot of them know this, it's just not really worth going after them. And so that's one of the other problems you have. Of course, with a higher priced property, a vacancy is more meaningful to you. In other words, it hurts more because you're losing more money every month. But at least when it comes to the flat fees that you have to pay to go and get a judgment and then later getting a collection agency to collect that judgment for you, if it's a larger money amount, they'll generally be more motivated to do it and it'll be more worth your time, or your property manager many times will do all that for you too. So that's one of the things. Generally speaking right now, I would err toward the end of the higher quality, slightly higher priced property, because remember, you're still way below the national median price with whatever numbers you just mentioned. So I would think slightly below the median price is a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what conclusion I've come to, which is pretty much what you said. I'm moving towards the higher priced properties, you know, in between somewhere between 90 and 140,000. Depends on what market. You know, sometimes 90 is a higher priced property in some markets, and sometimes it's 140. But for a couple of reasons. One is low hassle factor. I mean, for me, because I have a busy job and I have other interests in life that I want to spend my time on, I want as little low hassle as possible, even if that drops my cash on cash return a little bit. And the second thing is my first 10 loans, I've got a lot of leverage. You know, I'm financing at 20-25%, and I can take advantage. I can afford higher priced properties when I have that much leverage. When I get past 10, the terms are different. I have to put more down, or sometimes I have to pay all cash, and it's harder for me to reach into a $140,000 property if I'm paying 30 or 40% down, and certainly if I'm paying all cash. So the time for me to get the higher priced properties are when I'm in my first 10 loans, and then I'll kind of see later on what I can do. That's sort of, you know, my current strategy.
Right. That's another very good point you bring up. One of the big issues nowadays is the issue of what we call mortgage sequencing. And so it's where do you get your loans first? And we talked about that before, I believe, on our call, and how you sort of structure your loans, because you're limited to 10 Fannie Mae loans. And so you might as well get larger loan amounts, because that's the other thing. You know, it's 10. If they're 10 $50,000 loans or 10 $120,000 loans, it's the same to Fannie Mae. It's just the number of loans. And so you might as well get more leverage by getting higher loan amounts, higher purchase price. So that's another thing to think about. I don't think that in any of our markets right now, Tap, you should have to be spending $140,000. That would be pretty high. You could be easily around $120,000, and below that, 90 to 120 would be sort of our higher end, if you will. So when we're talking about high price properties, these are still very inexpensive. Well, other questions or thoughts that you've had? You know, maybe it's not a current question, but it's a past question that you were thinking about.
Well, I can update you a little bit. You know, you and I were talking a little bit about how to get access to cash. You know, I make a reasonable salary and I get cash coming in every, you know, disposable investable cash each month. But, you know, I wanted to kind of move more quickly. The faster I kind of build up the properties, the faster I'm getting those returns. And I think especially for people who are listening to you, they may be thinking about where they can get cash to invest. And I looked into things like active 401k loans and cash value life insurance. And I mean, the active 401k is a great thing. I had all my money in my company 401k plan in stocks because that's all they offer. And stock market's going up and down. And I just kind of wanted to, I basically decided you can take out up to $50,000 out of your 401k. And as long as you're still working at that company and you paid back interest, which is around 4% to yourself, to your 401k. So it's kind of, you know, circumventing the banks. You don't have to qualify for that. It comes in like a week. So I did that. And that's one of the ways I'm going to buy a couple of properties. And then there's also cash value life insurance, which, you know, I think is a little more complex and not everyone has access to that or has that kind of policy. But I think being creative with the ways to get cash without being foolish, but just being creative without getting it over your head, I've been picking that up a little bit. And, you know, you and I talked about that on the call.
Hey, let's talk about that cash value life insurance thing for a moment. I just want to go on record once again. I think that's a lame deal. I don't like it. It looks interesting on the face of it, but I just think that the life insurance companies are hoping that nobody understands inflation because that's how they're going to make all their money. They pay back in cheaper dollars. And the other thing I'd really consider nowadays, and this is something we've never touched on before 3 years ago, but you know, many of these life insurance companies, oh, they're AAA rated life insurance companies. They've been around for 200,000 years. And you know, nowadays, that's a lot less meaningful than before because what we have learned from the last financial crisis that we're still in, frankly, but when it really got severe 3 years ago, is that we've learned that these life insurance companies, number one, they can go out of business unless they're bailed out by the government. And I don't think the tolerance for bailouts is there anymore. So yeah. I think next time around, I don't think you'll see so many bailouts, okay, because people are just too upset about it. But number two, the ratings agencies, I mean, they're just so crooked. They've just been so debunked as to how they do their ratings, whether it be Moody's and Standard and Poor's. People have just, you know, they were just asleep at the wheel in rating all of these toxic assets last time around. So how can you trust them now?
Yeah, I can make two comments on that. One is, one of the things I love about investing is that I have to understand how the world works. I have to keep learning in order to be a smart investor. So I have to understand, you know, what's going on with the euro. I have to understand how insurance works. I have to understand all this. And, you know, so you kind of have to be like a broad-based learner. And the other thing about the cash value life insurance is I agree with you. I would not start a cash value life insurance policy as a way of having sort of access to cash and long-term, you know, death benefit and all that. It just so happened that my parents had started one in my name for their own estate planning purposes. So I happen to have one already with cash value in it. And I'm, instead of like sort of having it sit there and do nothing, I'm you know, using it as a way to get a loan and use that money. It's almost like equity in a house.
Right, right.
But I would never start one now. It just so happened it happened to be there, so I used it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend it.
Right, and you mentioned that to me on a prior call. Now you're just reminding me that you mentioned that. But, you know, I would say that your parents, had they taken and invested that money and done it themselves years ago when they bought that plan, they could have done much better with it. I'll just bet you.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. And so some brilliant life insurance salesman a long time ago figured out how you could rebrand life insurance as though it's an investment. And that's where, you know, look, folks, if you need life insurance, get yourself a cheap term life insurance policy. Insurance is fine. I have nothing against insurance. But when you start looking at insurance as though it's an investment, that's where I just say, no way. You know, I've heard the pitch of the bank on you concept. You know, Randy, who's been on the show before, he loves it, and we argue about it constantly. He's one of the people that we work with, and he refers business to us, and this is like our ongoing argument about, he says, Jason, someday I'm going to convince you about this life insurance thing. And I said, nah, I don't think you are, Randy, but, you know, and you hear those commercials, the bank on yourself, the bank on you, be your own bank. They're all over talk radio all the time. And those are just a lame deal. You know, they just, if people really understood them, they would say, and you know, there are books written on it. I mean, Doug Andrew has written a book on it, and you know, one of my pet peeves, but yeah. Now, have you considered TAP any of the private lending or hard money lending in terms of loaning out your own money too on a short-term basis?
I've looked into that. I've thought about it. I'm not doing it personally for two reasons. One is because I'm sort of in a wealth building mode here, and I'm really kind of going after using the cash that I do have to buy rental properties right now because of the interest rates and the prices and whatnot, and because the returns are so much better. And the second reason is that if I did those, I would probably want to do them in my retirement accounts because they're not as tax favored as rental properties. What I am recommending those sort of private money loans or doing the lending is to my parents, who have a very nice, comfortable nest egg, but just sit on cash because they're in their 60s and sort of not really, they're very conservative. And this is a simple thing. So I'm kind of suggesting to them that they look into or that they consider doing some private lending. Although even with them, I'm kind of getting them into buying rental property because I think that's way better. But yeah, the lending is sort of, it's down the line. I consider that sort of like a wealth preservation, diversification approach.
Talk about your experiences with having properties that are far away from where you live. Have you had any problems with that? You probably had reservations with it in the beginning, I guess.
Yeah, I had reservations, and when I talked to some people around here, including at these real estate meetings, you know, they were all kind of aghast at the idea of owning something that you couldn't walk to or drive to easily. But I've had nothing but a good experience. I've had two properties for about 6 to 9 months. Like I said, it's been easier than owning a stock. I mean, it hasn't been anything. There hasn't been a single phone call or problem. I'm sure there will be, but it hasn't been an issue. And then I just closed on St. Louis last week. It's a little more work because it's, you know, these older properties, so I want, like, the inspections require a little bit more work. But I look at all that as learning. You know, I get a chance to learn about how inspections work and how to do these things from a distance. But it's been easier than I expected, very manageable. I expect there to be some ups and downs in the future, but I'll kind of modify. If I find that something's too much of a hassle, I'll move away from that vendor or that market or that sort of type of property, and if I find it's manageable, I'll move more into it. But right now, I'm kind of exploring different types of properties.
Right, right, yeah. And so your focus is going to be on the higher end now. How many cities are you in now?
I'm currently in 3 cities, and I'm going to pick a fourth. And we talked about this too. I'm going to do 4 markets for my first 10. So I have 3 right now. One that you don't like, but we can talk about that. One's I do Memphis, St. Louis, and then I have Chicago. And then my fourth is going to be Atlanta. I like Atlanta, and I know you love Atlanta, but they're just so tight on inventory in Atlanta that I can't really get in. And I just kind of stopped trying for now. I'm going to do Dallas, and Dallas actually cash flows a little bit better. So I'm fine. I'm kind of 50-50 on those two markets anyway. As far as, like, you know, I could have gone either way. So Dallas is going to be my fourth market, which I visited last week, and it's awesome. It's amazing. You know, they're just building down there. It's like a different planet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Texas is so business friendly, you know.
Yeah.
Like I always say, it'd become the Hong Kong of the United States if it were to secede from the Union.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Good stuff. Well, and any questions or thoughts you want to just kind of wrap up with? I know you've got to get back to work and saving lives.
You know, I would just say the two best things that I've found about investing is it's a lot of fun. You know, you get to learn about a lot of things. You interact with lots of interesting people. Be careful and skeptical about really everyone at first, but, you know, over time you develop relationships with people that you like working with, which is also great. And then, you know, just speaking to someone who is a skeptic about everything before I get in, but enthusiastic skeptic, I can't really see any, I'm recommending real estate investing to my friends and family, and I would never do that if I just think on kind of every dimension it makes sense, including if you think that everything's going to crash because people still need a place to live. So to me, especially for residential real estate, it just makes so much sense. So I don't really want more competition out there for other investors buying properties I want, but it does make a lot of sense right now. And I think it's a good, you know, I'm enjoying the whole process. I'm having a lot of fun.
Good stuff. Well, Tap, thanks so much for joining us today. And we'd love to have you back on maybe, you know, in a year or so, just to kind of look back on more of your experiences as they unfold into the future. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Did you know that you can call into the Creating Wealth Show? Yes, you can call me and talk to me direct or later broadcast on the show. The number is 949-200-8009 or via Skype, Jason Hartman, ROI. Please make sure you have a good connection when you call, get your questions answered, participate in the show, and share your experiences with other investors. Call in 949-200-8009 or Skype, Jason Hartman, ROI, and participate in the Creating Wealth Show.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.